You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Past Macabre, where we journey through history to uncover how our relationship with death reflects the values, fears, and hopes that shape the way that people live. I'm your host, Stephanie Rice. Thank you for joining me for episode 32, Tombs of the Tomb Builders Part 2, Deir el-Medina. In this episode, we'll explore just a very small part of Deir el-Medina because it's one of the best preserved ancient Egyptian settlements and has a treasure trove of information. I'll share information that we've learned from texts and artifacts found in the village, as well as the nearby workers' cemetery, about the lives of three specific individuals who lived here over 3,000 years ago. That's how detailed the information is. We can fill a full and slightly long episode with just three individuals. So we'll take a look at the tombs and the personal monuments of the wealthiest man to ever live in the village, Ramosa. And then we'll explore the life of his successor, Kenir Kepershef, through the texts that were found in his tomb and the graffiti that he left across the Theban necropolis. And then we'll take a look at the last will and testament of Kenir Kepershef's wife, Naunakhte. It shows us that women during this period not only owned their own property, but they had full autonomy over it too. So without further ado, let's get started exploring Deir el-Medina. First, a little bit of context for the settlement and the necropolis where everybody that we're going to be talking about lived and then was buried. So the settlement that we now call Deir el-Medina was called Pademi, which translates to just the village. All of the texts that we have from here refer to it just as the village. We don't know if it had a different official name. If it has, it hasn't been found yet. It could just be that everybody just referred to it as the village in their texts because they knew what it meant, or it could have just been because of the nature of this settlement, it didn't get a formal name. The people who lived here were the artisans who worked on all of the nearby royal and very elite tombs in the necropolis of Thebes. That includes the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens. And there's also more elite necropoli or cemeteries within the wider Theban necropolis that are within the area nearby. The entire necropolis, including the area that the village is in, was called Set Mot, which translates to the place of truth. It's called the Theban necropolis in modern times, specifically because it was next to the ancient capital of Thebes, which is in Upper Egypt in modern-day Luxor. It was the capital of Egypt during the New Kingdom, as well as on and off during different periods. But for now, we're focusing on the New Kingdom aspects of it. The necropolis here, including the Valley of the Kings and the Valley of the Queens, as I said, are considered sacred spaces throughout Egypt's history once burials began here. So even after the capital moved, royals ensured that they would be brought back and buried in this area. The New Kingdom, and especially the time period when the capital was here at Luxor, was known as the Golden Age of Egypt, and many of the most well-known rulers of ancient Egypt that we know today were buried here, like Tutankhamun, Ramses II, aka Ramses the Great, Nefertari, the Queen of Ramses II, whose elaborate tomb is amazingly beautiful, and Hatshepsut, the queen who ruled as king herself. So, and that's just to name a few. There's tons and tons of burials here. The village at Deir el-Medina was inhabited from the 18th dynasty until the collapse of the New Kingdom at the end of the 20th dynasty. That would have been about 1500 BCE to about 1100 BCE. It's an incredibly well-preserved site, incredibly well, because it was so remote, both in ancient times and modern times. It's in the desert, about 2 kilometers away from the Nile, where it is presently, and even during ancient times, there was not a branch of the Nile that went near it. Water had to be brought into the settlement in ancient times, and now modern infrastructure is required to bring water in all the way from the Nile via pipes so that all of the tourism structures and the archaeologists who are out there studying can have running water. Very dry climates that are further away from the Nile make for excellent preservation conditions. And then another benefit is the remote location, because many ancient settlements are now covered by modern cities. Honestly, if it was a good place to live, chances are it is still a good place to live. So a lot of major cities, especially in Egypt and around the Mediterranean, there's near continuous habitation that's just built up on top of the ancient cities that were there, or the urban sprawl from the modern cities has engulfed what would have been more remote ancient cities. So opportunities like Deir el-Medina are very welcome windows into ancient daily life. We often get a lot of burials because that's usually what archaeologists are working on the most. That's what people tend to preserve the most because of the sacredness tied to burials. You're not really going to keep building cities on top of them, generally. But when it comes to these sorts of places that are super remote and we can actually get, like, we can see the homes that are so well preserved that we can tie them to specific individuals and their families. And the documents and artifacts that have been preserved here are so well preserved that entire family trees can be very accurately built out. And we can see people's legal disputes. We can see people's property rights. There's all sorts that we'll get into. Around the settlement and throughout the wider necropolis, there's graffiti all over the place. And this graffiti has been preserved and provides us glimpses into social life and sort of working relationships of various people throughout their times here. Based on where they are and the fact that many people identify themselves by name and title on the graffiti, it seems like it was a way to say I was here when visiting various locations across the necropolis. Sort of like if you've ever come across one of those giant walls at an event where you get to sign your name on it along with everybody else, something like that. Or maybe a wall at a favorite bar or something. So these would be in places that have evidence of temporary campsites, and also some places have evidence of work being done there. So they could have been work trips and people had to work remotely at some different tombs than usual. That would have been a difficult commute. Maybe they decided to camp out there, or maybe it was just for fun and they were working somewhere remote and decided, hey, I'm just going to camp and hang out with the bros. You know, it could have been lots of different reasons, but they generally do show people visited the same places multiple times. And while they can't be exactly dated, there's ways that you can tell based on the layering of it all that it's not like one guy signed his name 30 times on the same wall. It's more like one guy signed his name 30 times during different periods on the same wall. Some people specifically identify who they're traveling with whenever they sign, or like a group of friends or coworkers all sign together in a way that makes it very clear that they're there together, whether it's working or just hanging out. And there are some places where it seems like some people sign just because they managed to explore a unique spot that there's really no evidence of camping or working done, and it's kind of at a weird spot, but there's like a chunk of wall that's got carved names into it. So, you know, if you're out here in this desert and you're a little bit bored on your days off, maybe you're just wandering around, and essentially it's, like I said, a way to mark that you were there. Thanks to the graffiti and all of the texts and all of the tombs that have been well preserved, we can identify very specific individuals. And so first we're going to start off with the scribe Ramosa. He came to Deir el-Medina as an outsider. Most of the people who lived and worked here came from family businesses, essentially. So at the time period, in all of ancient Egypt, not just here, you inherited your job and you were trained by your parent and you followed in their footsteps. And it was the same here at Deir el-Medina. And so especially by the time that Ramosa was introduced here, there had already been several generations of people living and working. So it was very interesting that it's documented that as an outsider, he was appointed scribe of the tomb in year 5 of Ramses II's reign. And scribe of the tomb is a title given to essentially the head scribe over all of the scribes that worked here. He was a scribe who specifically worked on royal tombs and not just, you know, your regular quote-unquote elites. We know Ramosa began his career as assistant scribe to the hereditary prince after he went through scribal school at Thebes. So essentially, he went through training, graduated, got a really cushy job, and then that continued to advance him. He was considered one of the richest men in the entire village's history. He owned 3 different decorated tombs, which was a very big deal because even having one as a non-royal was very, very rare. And he had over 40 individual monuments at the various temple districts throughout Deir el-Medina. Several of his personal monuments that were placed are actually appeals to fertility deities about his inability to have biological heirs. So, like I said, things were so incredibly well documented here. We know some very intimate details about a lot of these citizens. Ramosa and his wife Mutemwia appealed to the goddesses Tawaret, Kudshu, and Hathor in order to have a child multiple times. Mutemwia was a priestess for Tawaret, and we can see that in a lot of the dedications given to her. And Kudshu was essentially a Canaanite goddess that was created by the Egyptians, if that makes sense. So she wasn't actually originally a Canaanite goddess, like sometimes happens where cultures will basically adopt a deity from another culture. In this case, the ancient Egyptians kind of took bits and pieces of Canaanite goddesses that they liked and added a little bit of an Egyptian twist to it, and then you get Khufu. And she was especially known as a fertility goddess. And then Hathor, who is probably the most famous fertility goddess in ancient Egypt's pantheon. And all of these 3 were very, very important, especially during the New Kingdom when it came to trying to have children. Since Ramosa had a very, very important job as the head scribe, he had to adopt an heir since he was unable to have one. And so he ended up adopting Kinner Kepeshef, who ended up following in his footsteps and becoming a very famous, very well-known, and very wealthy scribe here at Deir el-Medina. Kinner Kepeshef was born to a family that did already live and work here in the village. His father was named Panacht, and he was a servant in the Place of Truth, which was the title given to a lot of the supporting roles within the wider necropolis. They could have worked at some of the mortuary temples, but at lower levels and not been as priests. They could have just been some of the lower level laborers. They could have been more in charge, I guess, ultimately like middle management. Servant in the Place of Truth covers quite a few different roles. And Kinner Kepeshef's mother was named Sint Nefer. And it's unclear who the rest of her family is, but she was important enough that there was a documented day where all of the workers were given the day off in order to attend her funeral. That wouldn't have been done for just anyone in the village. We don't have documents of that for everyone. There were so many people, there would have been too many days off if they kept doing that. So it's very interesting that clearly Kinner Kepeshef came from a family that had roles here and were important here, and yet he was still adopted by Ramosa. When he was adopted by Ramosa, he served as his eldest son and inherited his estate and took over his professional position. And so even with his well-off family, they clearly didn't compare to the status he gained from inheriting the role of the lead scribe. Kinner Kepeshef rose to become the head scribe of the royal tombs, just as Ramosa was, but Ramosa did live quite a long time. And so it seems that while he was in training and kind of waiting for his position, Kinner Kepeshef made the most of it, and there's a lot of him exploring the area, working for private tombs, and because of this, There's a lot of different texts and reliefs in tombs that can be identified as Kinir Kepeshef's work because he had a very unique way of doing the hieratic writing as well as the hieroglyphic writing. Now, that's how we can identify a lot of scribes and a lot of their work in the ancient times. We don't have signed documents all of the time. Some are explicitly signed, which helps us first to identify the person who wrote it. But then afterwards, they're matched up with how their handwriting is. There's a way that people are able to study handwriting, and it's able to be matched to you as if it were like a thumbprint. And so people get very detailed, and they can tell Kinir Kepeshef wrote quite a lot of the documents and the tomb goods that were here in Deir el-Medina. During his time here, Kinir Kepeshef holds the record for the most graffiti in the entire necropolis. So again, as I said, he got around and he did a lot of exploration, and there's a lot of work spots of his too that have his graffiti. There's over 230 spots in the entire necropolis where he marked his name. In his tomb, there are a lot of copies of texts, which was how a lot of scribes practiced. And many of them show that they were a lot of elite texts from tombs all over the famous necropolises in Egypt, not just Thebes. So it seems that Kinir Kepeshef had a specific type of text that he liked to copy in order to practice. But one interesting thing that was found in his tomb, in addition to those texts, has been called the Book of Dreams. And it provides a glossary for dream interpretation, but it wasn't written by him. And we don't know if he actually cared about it necessarily, because one of his texts is on the flip side of it. So it may have just been scrap paper that he grabbed at some point and just reused. But it's actually a very interesting look into the way that people at the time would have believed in this sort of dream divination. And it's written so that all of the dreams with good meanings are in black text, black ink, and all of the dreams that have bad omens are in red ink. Some examples of the good omens that are identified are: if you dream of yourself sitting in a garden in the sun, it means a pleasurable time awaits you. If you dream about yourself demolishing a wall, it means purification from evil. Not destruction or anything like that, and it's not negative like you would assume. If you dream about eating crocodile meat, you'll become an official among your people. If you dream about offering water to someone else, it means prosperity for you. And these aren't all of the examples. There's actually quite a lot, but here's just a few of them. And just some examples of the bad omens, since we already went into the good. If you see yourself seizing up in one of your lower legs, it means that there's a report about you from those who are dead. That's usually interpreted as saying that they're basically telling the gods bad things about you. If you dream about being bitten by a dog, it means you're touched by magic in a negative way, like cursed, essentially. If you dream about being bitten by a snake, it means the arising of words against you, which basically means rumors are going to be started about you and spread. As far as I know, there actually haven't been any other copies of this Book of Dreams, so it may have just been one person's personal interpretations. It could have been just some sort of local folkloric tradition instead of something that was part of the wider belief system in ancient Egypt. That's the problem with these sorts of documents and trying to base information off of them, because just because we haven't found them anywhere else doesn't mean that they don't exist. It could just be that the preservation conditions just weren't good enough. Like his predecessor, Kinir Kepeshef lived a long life and served as the head scribe for several decades. He didn't appear to have biological children of his own, but unlike Ramosa, there's no documentation about it. So perhaps his only wife that we do know of may have come into his life a little bit too late and he was no longer able to produce them, or maybe he chose not to. It didn't seem to have been a problem, though, because his successor, Bai, didn't have to be adopted in order to succeed Kinir Kepeshef. So perhaps that's why he chose not to. As I said, he did have a wife. Her name was now Nakhde, and she was much younger than him. So again, we don't know exactly when they got married, just that she was much younger at the time, and she lived for several decades after he had passed. because she ended up having a full life even after Kinner Kepershef died, she's not buried in his tomb with him, though there is a statue of the two of them together that was found in his tomb. We actually know of her thanks to her last will and testament that was preserved. Documents about death are just as important, sometimes more so because they can be more detailed, as the tombs and physical remains that we can study. They offer us this window into what was truly important socially and personally to the deceased as they were nearing the end of their life and kind of had a chance to reflect and think on all of their experiences. We know now Nakhte was a free woman according to her will, and she actually owned property herself. She was able to inherit Kinner Kepershef's estate, even though Bai inherited his position, and after he passed away, she married again to the workman Kay Moon. She had 8 kids with him, and one of their sons, possibly the oldest, was actually named Kinner Kepershef after her first husband. So it's possible that this was the way that she was able to honor him, even though she wasn't able to have children with him during Kinner Kepershef's life. Her will was declared and drafted before the entire local court that consisted of 14 witnesses who all signed the document. So, like I said, we have a very detailed window into the legal proceedings and everything that was important to the people who lived here. In this case, we know that now Nakhte disinherited 3 of her children for not caring for her in old age. And her will also specifically separates her property and wealth from both of her husbands. The will specifically states that 3 children she disinherited are still entitled to inherit from their father separately. And so this is a very interesting way that we can actually see the level of power and autonomy that women had in the New Kingdom. And this legal contract also gives us a hint at the social contract of the expectations that were just socially widely accepted that children should be caring for their aging parents. Considering this was actually done by a court, and during this period, it's not like a will would have been this whimsical desire that would have just been signed off on. The court had to agree to these sorts of things because it's dealing with properties that impact taxes and all sorts of other disputes that can arise from wills that are kind of neglected when it comes to legality. Now, as I said, we have so much information about so many people here and their extended families that I could keep going with these connections between Ramosa, Kinner Kepershef, and now Nakhte, but we would be here forever, or we would have just a series of episodes on the people of Deir el-Medina. So we're going to go ahead and end it here, but I do just want to reiterate that from both the village to the tombs, we continue to learn so much about the people who once lived here, and that's why archaeological excavations, even in places we know so much about, are still very, very important. Because there's still new finds being made every single field season there. And these finds provide an invaluable window into what life was like in ancient Egypt for the non-elite citizens during the New Kingdom. Thanks for joining me for episode 32. For the next episode, we'll be leaving Deir el-Medina, but staying within the New Kingdom period. If you are interested in learning more about Deir el-Medina, there are links for additional sources in the show notes and on my new Substack, which is called The Past Macabre Research Notes. If you'd like me to cover more about Deir el-Medina, you can actually let me know there on the Substack because there's a feedback survey at the end of every Substack post. You don't even have to subscribe. You can just click on the post and then click on the feedback button. Join me for the next episode, and we'll take a look at ancient Egypt's Armageddon, also known as the Battle of Megiddo. It was won by Thutmose III and brought much of ancient Syria and Palestine into the Egyptian Empire. So thanks again for listening. Until next time.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to keep up with new releases. Please leave a rating and a comment. That helps the show reach others who may be interested in the past macabre. For access to bonus content from all Archaeology Podcast Network shows, become a member at arcpodnet.com/members. That's ARCHPODNET.com/members. You can find show notes for this and other episodes at arcpodnet.com/TPM and follow Past Macabre on Instagram. That's PAST_MACABRE. You'll find pictures of the sites and artifacts discussed, Q&A sessions, and episode topic votes. Hope to see you there.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.